We'll get started. Heavenly Father, thank you for Pastor Jay ministering to us this morning through your word, and that he'll do so again in second service. Pray for this hour we have now, that what we talk about will give us confidence in the true faith that we have through your word, and equip us to confront the things of this world that are contrary to your truth. Pray that it be glorifying to you and edifying to us in Jesus' name. Amen. This is broken, so. All right, we're not going to worry about that right now. This week, we will be covering another secular worldview like we did a few weeks back with naturalism. And this would really be the other kind of common baseline secular worldview that we encounter in our culture, similar to naturalism and everything that flows with that. This would be the other one that competes, so to speak, with other worldviews that are more religious in nature, like Christianity or others. And that worldview, sorry about that, is postmodernism, which I mentioned last time. I will say postmodernism is a little more difficult to put into a nice box like naturalism was. We've probably heard about postmodernism. You hear about it in architecture and art mostly. Sean talked about that a little bit in week two, and that's more the context you hear. But it's not as straightforward as naturalism, where it's very clear they're really interested in hard facts, the scientific method. We can easily pull out the core tenets from something like naturalism, or even secular humanism, which you could call a subset of naturalism. They're kind enough to just publish a humanist manifesto telling you exactly what they believe. But postmodernism isn't quite as clean as that, but I think we can still pull out some of the basics, some of the distinctive elements of postmodernism, and then see what the consequences of those beliefs are in our culture. So we'll look for those themes that we're seeing in real life and try to talk through those. We'll go through the takes model like we have in previous ones. So first, the basic idea. This is really going to bother me that this isn't working. So give me 1 second, please. I tried to make a cool countdown timer, and it's ruined everything. And I don't want you looking at me the whole time, so make sure to get something up here. There we go. Postmodernism. All right. So first, what's the basic idea of postmodernism? For each of the worldviews we cover, I'm going to try to boil it down to like a real basic idea to kind of be the center of the wheel, and then we'll go through kind of filling it out with the spokes. But the basic idea of postmodernism is this: that there is no objective reality. There is no objective reality. Sounds kind of like a crazy thing to say, but we'll unpack that idea in a little bit more detail as we go. But the key word to focus on here is the word objective, that they would suggest there's no objective reality. So to borrow a tagline from the X-Files, where we would say the truth is out there. The truth is something out there for us to be discovered. It exists outside of us. That's the motto of one of the main characters, if you ever watched X-Files. But that would be the motto of the scientist, of a historian, of a detective, of course, of a Christian, that we need to go find the truth, something out here. But for the postmodernists, it's basically the exact opposite position. A self-conscious postmodernist would say that the truth isn't some objective thing out there to go be discovered. They would suggest there's not any kind of truth that exists on its own outside of anybody's perception of it. They wouldn't, like we might say there's a capital T truth, like full stop, something that would be true regardless if anybody ever even knew about it. That kind of thing does not exist for the postmodernist. And that's the basic idea, and we'll try to flesh that out a little bit. So why is postmodernism a thing? Where did this idea come from? Why is it so popular? That could be a whole long discussion of how we got to this point, so I just want to cut it down to a few basic reasons of why this is even a thing, as crazy as it sounds. And the first is a disillusionment with modernism. So you can tell from the name postmodernism, it comes after modernism. So what's modernism? Modernism is basically what we talked about last time with naturalism, but it's an intellectual and cultural outlook that came from the Enlightenment period, so like the 17th and 18th centuries. They were really keying in on things like human reason and the scientific method. They're really dismissive of things like divine revelation. They put a great emphasis on the sciences, and then also human reason, our ability to rationally think and come to true conclusions. So very, very connected to naturalism that we talked about last time. And modernism didn't, like, it's not disappeared. So postmodernism coming into place didn't remove modernism. It's still a very popular outlook, again, tied to naturalism from last time. But there were a lot of thinkers in the 20th century that became disillusioned with that modernist thought because modernism had a lot of promises that it brought with it, and it didn't deliver on those promises. If you remember when we talked about the salvation outlook of naturalism last time, we talked about, you know, how science would be the savior. We could solve all of our problems through science, but it had become clear to these thinkers that science had not and still has not saved us. For example, the same scientific breakthroughs that gave us atomic energy also brought the atomic bomb, bringing with it all kinds of pain and destruction. They also thought that if not science, human reason could save us. If we could all lay aside our religious superstitions, all think rationally and consistently, then we could all, as human beings, come to a consensus and agreement on all the major issues that had been dividing us for so long and causing us to go into conflict. If we could just come to a rational conclusion, we would be able to save ourselves that way as well. But that also clearly hadn't and has not happened. It seems now there's more disagreement in culture than ever before. And then along with that, there were also big cultural movements in that time period that eroded the appeal of modernism, one being globalization, but then also pluralization and egalitarianism. We started to realize, you know, there's really a vast diversity of perspectives around the world, not just the way that we Westerners think. So coming to a simple consensus maybe isn't as easy as it initially sounded. So the idea here, again for the dissatisfied modernist, would be that thinking that there's only one way to think is an outdated way of thinking. It's going to be hard to say a lot of sentences today with this point of view, but they concluded that the Western way of thought wasn't the only way, so it seems we can't use one way of thinking to come to a same conclusion. The second big idea came from the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. You've probably heard of this, his movement of the death of God, that God is dead. He didn't literally mean that God had died as if God could die, but it was that the idea of God was dead. So the biblical idea of a creator God who's created all things, sustains all things, is the final authority, the ultimate standard, Nietzsche said that that idea has been discredited. Right, so he spoke about the death of God in culture and that society needed to come to terms with the idea that you couldn't credibly believe in God anymore. And he was saying this in the late 1800s. But if you're going to say that, if you're going to say that God is dead, that's going to have some crucial downstream implications. If we don't have a God-centered universe, you're going to end up with some of the same consequences as we talked about with naturalism last time. And we'll really see those when we get to knowledge and ethics. But this God is dead idea gained a lot of steam, and then we definitely still see the impact of that, as well as these other things, in our culture today at large. So that's some of the basics of postmodernism. What we'll do now is we're going to see if we can take postmodernism through our TAKES acronym, the T-A-K-E-S, to see what postmodernism would have to say about those different categories. So like always, we'll start with the T for theology. Remember, when we talk about the theology of a worldview, it's not just its view of God, but its view of ultimate reality. So if we're going to talk about the ultimate reality for the postmodernists, what would be their perspective? Well, they would have to say that there really is no objective ultimate reality. So what we think of as ultimate reality, or what the less enlightened generations would call ultimate reality, they would say is just a human construction. There actually is no reality that's independent of human thought and human activity and how humans describe things. So in this perspective, reality depends on what we think and how we talk about stuff. So when we speak about the way things really are, the real world, what we're really doing in this perspective is just talking about how we've decided to describe the world. It isn't necessarily how the world is, but it's how we've decided to talk about it and then think about our experiences. So in this perspective, if you think through it, there's really no distinction between our interpretation of reality and reality itself, again, for the postmodernists. So what that means is that how I think about the world or how I interpret the world is how the world truly is for me. And the postmodernists will say, you know, we don't have access to anything beyond our own experiences, so that the way the world appears to us, why make a distinction between how it appears and how it is? So that's a bit of that perspective. And if you follow that, if you kind of follow that train of thought for a while, you could actually change reality, or the way the reality is for you, just by thinking about it differently. It's going to get crazy today, so hang on. How about God specifically? What does it actually say about God? Well, on the surface, postmodernism would suggest that whether or not there is a God depends on what you think about it. It depends on your particular religion's perspective. So it's very characteristic of a postmodernist to say that, like, religious truths about God, or for Christian truths about Jesus Christ, are person or community relative beliefs. So for a particular community, those things are true, right? But they're not transcendental, absolute, objective truths. They're just the way certain people or a certain community, like the Christian church, happens to think about these things and understand their world. So on the surface, it's very accommodating to the idea of God that there is a God if you think there is. If you see the world in God terms, good for you and your community, there is a God. But if you dig beneath that surface, it becomes quite clear that postmodernism would have to reject the idea of God, at least the biblically defined God. For postmodernists, there really could be no God like the God of Scripture, because if that God exists, he would be the ultimate reality. He would be the source of objective truth. He would be the one determining what is morally right, morally wrong, all these kinds of things. There would be objective reality and objective standards, which is completely at odds with the whole postmodernist experiment. So while it seems like it, they'd be fine with you having your God, they don't actually make that accommodation in reality. So that's their theology. Moving on to their anthropology, and again, sorry for having to use the big word, but that's the only way to get the acronym to work right. But this is asking, what does the worldview have to say about human beings? Like, what are we? What are we like? Where do we come from? And where are we going? Well, according to the postmodernist, what are human beings? Well, remember, in postmodernism, reality is just a human construction of thought and language. It's how we talk about things. So reality isn't defined by something outside of ourselves. It's defined by human beings. So the truth about anything isn't something that exists up here outside of us, that stands above us, that we're then subject to. So what that implies then in terms of what are human beings is that we ultimately are whatever we say or think we are. We get to determine what human beings are, and that means that we are whatever we choose to be. And hopefully you're starting to see where this kind of thinking goes. But if we are the ones who are free to choose to think about the world and ourselves in any way that we feel like, and that is reality, well, if it works for you, then it's true for you. So what this means is that there is no actual view of human nature as such that has a full category of human nature in any kind of fixed or objective sense. It's not anything that is defined from somewhere outside of ourselves. We weren't created by anyone. We weren't born with an inherent disposition or a default settings. Like a naturalist would say, you know, maybe we are what we're made of. They could say something like that. But the postmodernist would also reject that. We are fully self-determined. So there's no universal human nature. We are what we say we are. From that, that also would have to mean that there's no objective, overarching purpose or meaning to life, which would also mean that there are no objective obligations or expectations for human beings. Nothing is placed over us from the outside. And there would also be no objective constraints on our thinking or our behavior, because where would they come from, right? So it's very similar consequences to what we talked about with naturalism, just coming from a different way of thinking. So you may already be making your way there yourself, but just to give a cultural couple examples of what this kind of thinking leads to, a thought about what human nature is, or the lack of a thought about what human nature is. The biggest postmodern perspective today, which we're getting just a full-on attack from the culture, from the highest levels, would be the LGBTQIA, et cetera, movement. But specifically the T for transgenderism, is just a complete rejection of objective reality. So the idea that somebody could be born a male, but they're actually a female on the inside, right? And people will take drastic measures of doing surgeries to try to make their outside reality reflect their inward feelings, or take very dangerous medications to do so. This whole thing, which was a fringe movement like a decade ago, I was actually listening to a lecture on postmodernism from 2012, and the speaker said, "Now there is such a thing, a term you may have come across called transgenderism." It seemed like it was even hard for him to say. I don't think you could be alive right now without knowing more than you ever wanted to know about transgenderism. And just 10 years ago, it was a fringe movement. But anyway, this self-identifying as something that is objectively not the case, and then expecting reality to then conform to that self-identification, that's all postmodernist thought. You would have the same thing with the whole personal pronoun concept, also part of mainly the T in the LGBTQ family. Pronouns are no longer just simply using the rules and syntax of grammar and language based on the sex of the individual, because now we have gender allegedly being a different thing that is no longer objectively tied to biological sex. So while a doctor may have guessed and assigned my gender of male at birth, if I don't feel like that, I can say, you know what, you can't use he, him pronouns when talking to or about me. I would actually prefer you to use they, them, or ze, zer, or I've heard lots of weird things there. And actually, I don't request that. I demand that you do those things. But this is a very, very postmodernist idea, and hopefully you see how you get there. If you say that what we say is what is, you can say whatever you want, and that's what is. But this idea of an individual self-determining, even how the rules of grammar and language work to turn something into their truth, we have all these things that have been fixed for thousands of years are now malleable because of a postmodernist way of thinking. And even these things can change over time. I've actually seen some videos, I don't know why I watch them, it's not good for me, but people that wear bracelets so that you know which pronouns to use for them on any given day. I feel like I can't access the internet anymore without just seeing Romans 1 on the screen, God turning people over to their sins. It's really devastating to see. But so much of it comes from this postmodernist way of thinking. My point with this, the whole gender spectrum schema is trans and transgenderism, all that, is the logical conclusion of postmodernist thought. If there's no definitive morals, no definitive human nature, no definitive truth, all that's just a social construction. Well, if something's been constructed by humans, then humans can reconstruct it however we see fit. Who says there's only two genders? Well, we did. We constructed that. There's no outside authority. We said so. So now if we want to say there's three, well, then there are three, or 300, or 3,000. There would be no logical end to a perspective like this. There's no breaks on postmodernist thought, which is why I'm not a prophet or the son of a prophet, but I said several years ago that pedophilia would be the next thing, that we'd start to see it being redefined as just another acceptable social or sexual preference, and we're actually starting to see that. It's terrifying. We're seeing pedophilia being renamed as minor attracted persons, or MAPS, if you've heard that, to try to destigmatize that sexual preference. God help us. But any of this stuff, this whole slide, would have been immediately rejected, like out of hand, without argument, evidence, or proof, by every one of our grandparents, right? This would be an absurd, well, they wouldn't know what PowerPoint is, but it'd be an absurd slide to look at. But now we have the leader of the free world, we have the Fortune 500 companies all celebrating and affirming and promoting life-altering body mutilation surgeries and devastating hormonal therapies and medications for kids as young as 8, if not younger. As long as they say that there's something different than they objectively are, we affirm it, let's take drastic measures to do it. I could talk about that for much longer than you want to hear, so we'll have to move on. But if you want to hear more about kind of the source of this movement and its implications, I would highly recommend a book by Carl Truman called Strange New World, talking about the expressive individualism and modern self. He has a very much longer version called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self that's more academic, that's like 600 pages. Nobody's going to read that. But Strange New World is much smaller. And as you know, I am a fan of small books. So I'd recommend that. But anyway, that's probably the most in-our-face postmodernism today. I don't really care about the weird art and architecture. It's this kind of postmodern thought that's really impacting our culture today. Some other quick things that will follow. This perspective would also have to mean that there are no intrinsic authorities or hierarchies among human beings. So start to think of the nuclear or the biblical family. That's not a fixed thing. And there are also no genuine inequalities between human beings or boundaries. There's no fixed boundaries for what humans can or can't do or can or cannot be. For the same reason, who would set the boundaries? If we're the ones thinking about it, we get to set them ourselves. And that's where egalitarianism, I mentioned just in passing on the other one, but this is their perspective that humans need to be and are absolutely equal, not just equal in value before God or even equal before the law, which is a confession that really only we can justifiably hold, but absolute equality. And we'll see that a little bit later. So that's the anthropology. Moving on to knowledge. So what does the postmodernist think about knowledge? Well, typically they'd be very, very skeptical of human knowledge and the powers of human reason. They would say that no one truly knows anything. No one knows anything in an absolute sense. The very idea that knowledge exists outside of us, right, outside of the perception of individuals, has been abandoned for the postmodernist. So like believing in universals, believing in universal truth, that's just a hangover from the Enlightenment way of thinking. And the postmodernists know better than to think in that way. They don't know better because they don't know anything. But again, I don't know how to say these sentences otherwise. Every sentence kind of turns into a paradox in this point of view, but they don't care. So we'll get to that later. But in this view, no one can know anything for certain because there is no objective truth or knowledge to be had. Because remember, if we're talking about truth at all in a postmodernist perspective, again, it's just a human social construction. So we're really creating truth by the way that we speak or by the way that we act. There's no objective truth out here somewhere. Truth for them is always defined by either individuals or societies. And if that's what you're going to confess, that's going to radically affect your view of knowledge. So knowledge is no longer about coming to understand the way that things are, the way that things really are. In this view, knowledge is more about creating new truths from your own way of thinking. Not aligning your thinking to how things are, but turning the way things are into how you think about them, if that makes sense, which it does not. How about human reason, like our ability to logically come to conclusions? So I'm talking about like the laws of logic here. These would be laws of thinking that we would say humans discovered. We didn't invent the laws of logic. And we would say that the laws of logic are based on the character of God, like the law of non-contradiction that says that A and non-A can't both be true at the same time and in the same way. We would say that's a valid rule of thought and it reflects reality. And it's valid because it also is a reflection of God's character. Saying that it's true that my car is in the north parking lot and it's also not true that my car is in the north parking lot, that would be a violation of this law of non-contradiction. And it would essentially be a lie to say that. And we're commanded not to lie. And God is not a liar and he cannot lie. So we would say valid way of thinking. There were thinkers like Plato and Aristotle. They popularized and articulated these laws of logic in terms of giving them names and categorizing them. But this is how humans have been hardwired to think since creation. This isn't anything that we've invented as humans. Unless you're a postmodernist, in which case you would reject that there are any universal laws of thinking, that there are universal ways to rationally go from premise to conclusion. So for them, the postmoderns, there are no universal standards of reason. There can be different standards of reason. People reason in different ways, or they communicate in communities different ways to come to their truth. They might say that one man's logic is another man's lunacy, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a matter of your perspective. Eastern philosophies, for example, often seem kind of weird to us as Westerners. They would say, you know, what's the sound of one hand clapping? It's that. Move on. Or if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around, does it make a sound? Obviously, it does. But they have a different way of thinking about those things. So the postmodernists would say, you know, the idea of what sounds reasonable, what makes sense to you, well, that's just based on your culture, your background, and your perspective. There's no fixed way to think or fixed way to come to conclusions or make a rational argument. A quick aside on that, if you make an argument of any kind, you are already assuming fixed laws of logic. So to even argue that there are no fixed laws of logic presupposes those fixed laws of logic. So I don't know where you hang out, but if somebody ever said to you, there are no fixed laws of logic, you could reply with something like, I think the seven smells purple. And when they look at you like a weirdo and say that didn't make any sense, you could say, oh, sorry, I didn't know you expected me to reason in your Western way of thinking. That's from my forthcoming book of How to Get a Stranger to Punch You in the Face. But anyway, argument presupposes logic. After punching you in the face, the postmodernist might try to say something like, experience is a better guide to finding truth than using reason, for example. Reason won't get us where we want to be. It's let us down in the past, so instead we need to rely on our experiences to tell us what is true. It's kind of a go with your heart rather than your head model, the Disney princess model of coming to decision making. So that's knowledge. I know we're flying, but moving on to E for ethics. So this is ethics and morality. What is the postmodern view of morality and ethics? Well, this is going to be a pretty similar slide to what we talked about with naturalism. They come to a lot of the same conclusions. Even though they start at very different kind of foundational assumptions, their most foundational declaration that there is no God gets them to very similar conclusions here. So for the postmodernist, they would have to say, if they're being consistent, that there is no objective distinction between good and evil, right and wrong. There are no transcendental standards of what is good and what is bad. So that would mean that there are no objective moral standards. We could never say as a postmodernist that something is right, period, or it's wrong, period, end of story for everyone, everywhere. Morality, like truth, we covered a minute ago, is also just a human cultural convention. Human beings have gotten together and we've agreed this is how we're going to live. We're going to say that this is right. We're going to say this is bad. We're going to say this thing is wrong, at least for now, for us. So morality, like truth, is going to be relative either to the individual. So what is right or wrong for me might be different than what's right or wrong for you. You do what's right in your own eyes type of thinking. Or it's relative to societies. So a society will come together and have some kind of agreement on what's considered right and wrong, and that will make it right or wrong for them. So morality by majority vote, in a way. Some examples of how they would argue this case would be to look at something like polygamy. So is having multiple wives morally right or morally wrong? Well, they would say it depends on your culture. In Western culture, polygamy is frowned upon. We've made it illegal in this country, and it's generally considered immoral. I don't expect that to last too much longer. But if we think about certain tribes in Africa, polygamy is not just allowed, but it's like celebrated. The more wives a man has, the higher his social standing in that society. So the postmodernists will say, well, see, there you go. There's no objective right or wrong about polygamy. It's not absolutely wrong. It's only right or wrong according to your culture. So it is both right and wrong, depending where you are. Another example would be, if we want to think about time, maybe homosexuality. You would find a very different moral verdict on homosexual behavior in, say, 17th century Europe versus 21st century America. It goes from being illegal to, again, celebrated. And for those people in the past, that 17th century Europe while they may have been unenlightened, a postmodernist would have to say it was morally wrong for them, but now it's morally right. So it's dependent on location, time, societies, all these kinds of things. So here they would say something like, one man's virtue is another man's vice. That's kind of the idea here, that what one person considers virtuous might be considered wrong by somebody else, but again, that's okay. That's just how things go if you're going to be a relativist. However, there is one caveat. There is one giant, undeniable, unbreakable, universal moral absolute in the postmodern point of view, and that's the absolute of tolerance. You could call it totalitolerance, which is a paradox, of course, with the whole system of how they should view right or wrong. But this is something that is objectively wrong for them, and that would be to be intolerant, which would mean, in terms of ethics, that you should never say that people with a different opinion than you about what is moral, that they're wrong about that. Like saying that you are right about something and that they are wrong would imply some kind of objective truth, and it's wrong to do that, okay? Try and keep up. It also means that you should never say that people who have different behaviors than you, like say a polygamist or a homosexual or whatever, you would never say that they are immoral. Because again, that would imply some kind of objective moral standard. There's like a universal moral standard that you are living up to and they are not. And it would be immoral to do such a thing as to call someone else immoral, okay? We might say it this way, that the one moral absolute is that you should never suggest that there are any moral absolutes. And if I haven't made it glaringly obvious yet, hopefully you're anticipating what one of the key lines of objection to this worldview will be. But we'll get there in a few minutes. But before that, let's talk about salvation. So another disclaimer, when we're talking salvation, it's not necessarily the Christian understanding of salvation, but it's how does that worldview think about salvation in a broad sense. What's wrong with the world and how does it need to be put right? What are our biggest problems and what are the solutions? Well, for the postmodernist, kind of like with the naturalist, if they're being consistent with their standards, which they probably aren't, but if they were, what they would have to say is that there is no real problem, like objectively speaking, that applies to everybody, because there's no objective reality, remember? So the true blue postmodernists would have to say there is no right answer to this kind of question. Individuals could have an answer that might be right for them, but not right for somebody else, or maybe even a culture could have an answer to a problem that they have, but there's no universal problem to be solved and no universal solution to such a non-problem. But nevertheless, like most naturalists, they're not actually going to be consistent with what their worldview necessitates. You can't really take a purely relativistic view. So what we find in practice anyway is that people that are generally postmodernists in their perspective will still say that there's a problem in the world, or at minimum they'll say that relative to us today, to the human race right now, there are problems that we need to address. So if they're going to do that, if we allow them that, the problems for them would typically be one of two things, or maybe both of these. We already kind of touched on one, the first one being intolerance, the fact that people don't accept others who differ from them. You know, we have people in the world who are racist or sexist or homophobic or transphobic and so on. The fact that people in our society don't accept other people who differ from them is a problem. Now, a note here, intolerance has taken on a new definition, you've probably noticed. Racism is a real thing, and it is really a sin when it's expressed outwardly or even felt in the heart. To hate a man or a woman based on their skin tone or think of them as less than a person based on ethnic background or religious background or whatever, that is sinful. To hate a person based on being a practiced homosexual, to hate them or think of them as less as a person is indeed sinful. But to make a value judgment of the behavior of an individual, calling that sinful, regardless of who they are, and even saying as much in public or even in private, while still respecting the person as a person and coexisting with them, that used to still be considered being tolerant of somebody. But now what I just described would still be hateful intolerance. To not wholeheartedly affirm somebody and the decisions that they make that are different than yours would be considered intolerance in this new definition of the word. And that is the kind of behavior that a postmodernist would say needs to be stopped. The other problem, they would say, is the problem of inequality, or maybe to use a more trendy word now, would be inequity. So I again mentioned briefly that postmodernism is very egalitarian in the sense that they want to obliterate any sense or claim of objective differences or genuine inequalities between people. So the postmodernists will say, this is a big problem, this inequity. Some people have things that other people don't. We have pretty good medical care here in America, but people in Africa don't. That's a bad thing. Something needs to be done about it, which we can relate to that. That makes sense. But they would also say some people get paid more for their job than other people doing a different job. That too is a bad thing, and something needs to be done about it. And that's what leads to ideas about, I don't want to get political, but like wealth redistribution and all those kinds of things, is we need absolute equality among people. Well, if those are the problems, then what are the solutions? Well, they need to match the problem. And if the problems are intolerance and inequality, the solution would be to get rid of those things. So eradicate intolerance, either by re-education or force, and then eradicate inequality by the same means, re-education or force. And by re-education, I'm not like tinfoil hatting here, okay, like having re-education camps in the USA, at least not yet. I mean, that wouldn't be unique historically. But think of this as the whole idea of becoming woke. Right? Those that have become enlightened to these truths, have obtained this special knowledge, part of their job is to then awaken or awoken, I don't know, other people, awaken the non-woke. And this could be through, we've seen some curriculum in schools, luckily not in Central Illinois yet, but formal education, but it's mostly public, like rhetorical means, maybe even getting corporations to influence this way. It's generally not a formal public debate where you can debate the ideas. But it's more, again, I don't want to use a scary word, but it's more indoctrination type tactics of just constantly reinforcing things through repetition, through rhetoric and force of words. And I don't mean like force of the law, but using forceful words, using force of like humiliation and shame for people that don't agree. And remember, I've mentioned this inescapable principle before of it's not whether but which. Whoever is in power is going to attempt to indoctrinate. I mean, I'm indoctrinating my children, spoiler alert. We indoctrinate our children with a set of values, beliefs, a way of viewing the world, but so does the postmodernist, so does the naturalist, so does the Buddhist, or whatever. It's not whether society will be indoctrinated, it's which set of standards will be used to indoctrinate them, is all. So my point here is that's what they do here, and in this case, the standard that they're shooting for is this universal tolerance and universal equality. So the goal, again, is to eradicate those. So what we can see being done in those cases is that those that are of this point of view try to make people like us feel stupid, feel mean or bigoted, or feel unfashionable and out of touch. And any view that is not their woke, enlightened view is looked at in a embarrassing way or a way of humiliation. So that's generally the approach, is to not argue the case and come to a consensus, but to forcefully get people on board through humiliation and stuff like that. So that would be the solution for them, though. Get everybody to have these point of views. Yeah, Gabe, question?
Sorry, I just wrote that. I'm having a hard time understanding why inequality is a problem for postmodernists. Can you explain that? I mean, the whole premise of postmodernism is you, then what does it matter if somebody's poor, if somebody's rich, somebody's this or somebody's that, as long as it's working for them?
I don't know. You're right, Gabe. Those are good questions. We'll get to some when we evaluate. Okay. You probably have come to the conclusion that none of this makes any sense, right? Correct. And we're going to talk through that and kind of how you evaluate something like this. This just seems to be flooded with contradiction. Yeah.
Just the way that, you know, I view, you know, some of these views in real life, it's very piecemeal. You know,
yeah.
You want the way you feel, but you will feel, you know, oppressed or, you know, unequal to everyone else. So you're just piecing after parts of it.
Yeah. You see a lot of naturalist postmodernists, which is like a contradiction in term, but they pick the thing that works for the argument they're trying to make. And if you were ever in like an, let's call it an apologetic debate with them, those are the kind of things you want to pursue, is you want to take it down to that bottom level to see what's your foundational belief And does that lead to the conclusions you're making, or are you jumping all over the place with it? Yeah.
See, that is the irony of it all, right? Is that, you know, the biggest argument, right, is that we want everyone to believe exactly as we do about the fact that everyone should be able to believe whatever they want.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's that extreme irony about that. We want you to think exactly the way you want to think, but you can't think any way other than the way we think.
Makes sense. You got it. Yeah. Yeah. So let's do that. I have a few. I mentioned these tools of critiquing last time, some of the head tools to critique the worldview on its own terms, and then also more heart tools of saying, you know, can we actually live with this point of view? Let's go through some of these quickly. The head tools, I think we'll see. I'll still go through it because it's valuable for us. But the head tools with the postmodernist thinking this way, they just don't care. Right? So the more effective one, I think, are the heart tools. But we'll get there in a second. We'll do the head tools because it's still good for us to know. So first, I want to talk about the consistency of the worldview, which you guys have all pointed out. There isn't any. And this is really the biggest logical critique of this perspective is that it's just chock full of all kinds of quite blatant and fatal inconsistencies. I mean, honestly, we're going to do an exercise here. You can refute this worldview in a single sentence with a single question. So this might be the biggest softball question you're going to get in Sunday school, where the answer isn't just God, Bible, or Jesus. But I think you can do it, okay? If somebody says to you, there is no truth, what do you say back to them?
Is that true?
There we go. Is that true, right? Now, if they haven't just picked up how their entire worldview has caved in on itself, and they would say something like, yes, that's true, then you could follow up, like, what do you mean by that? In what sense is it true? Is it objectively true? Because if it is, you just contradicted yourself. If it's not objectively true and it's just true for you, why should anybody else care about it? Why does your truth matter to me? I mean, I don't know what else to say about it when you're evaluating on these terms. And you might be thinking, is it really that easy to destroy and discredit this worldview? Well, logically, yes, it is. Postmodernism really is that inconsistent and self-defeating. But just saying, is that true, probably isn't job done, because it depends on if the person actually cares. And generally, if they're holding this perspective, they don't care that they've just contradicted themselves. They're not going to abandon their point of view, likely, for that. They might try to water it down and say, well, I just mean everyone has a unique perspective. Well, duh, right? We all agree with that. That doesn't mean that universal truth doesn't exist. But that's going to be just one of the many examples you could use with postmodernism. We looked at a couple that if you just apply the perspective to itself, it cancels itself out. It's self-refuting and self-defeating. But it's laughable for us, right? We're going to look at some more stuff that is also laughable. But I want to try to think through this as Christians on here, to say something like, is universal tolerance possible in principle, right? Let's try to think that way. And I'm going to use a bumper sticker to share this one with you, because I think that's the best way to really evaluate worldviews is via bumper sticker. But I found this online when looking for a different bumper sticker. It says, notice, intolerance will not be tolerated. This may have been a joke, I don't know, but you still hear things like this. You'll hear things like, this is an inclusive space. If you're not going to be kind, you are not welcome here. It's like, well, what did you mean by inclusive? But there's no actual standard. So you end up with nonsense like this that is just blatantly inconsistent. But that's kind of the thing about postmodernism, is you don't actually need to be consistent. You don't need to be worried about things like the laws of logic or being rational. So they often don't care. But I still quickly want to say, well, what would a Christian have to say about these things? So really quickly, the Christian worldview, we of course would say that there is objective truth, and that there is one right worldview. There is one right way of thinking about the world, and it's the way that God has revealed himself to be and the world to be through his scripture. And there's nothing inconsistent about that. Within the Christian worldview system, that's a very consistent, acceptable thing to say. Whether or not someone thinks it's true is one thing, but it's rationally consistent. There's no self-defeating problems in there. But of course, in postmodernism, they would say that there's no objective truth and there is no right worldview. They would want to distance themselves from saying that there is one right way to think about the world. But that's a weird thing to say if they're trying to argue that their worldview is right, right? Because if what they say is true there, then postmodernism itself can't be objectively true. It can't be the right worldview if there is no right worldview. Because if there is no right worldview, then postmodernism can't be the right worldview. It's a mouthful. But it negates itself as a possible worldview. You could say about postmodernism, kind of like was said before, that postmodernism is the worldview that repudiates all worldviews and thereby repudiates itself. But again, as I said, this is mostly for us. The postmodernists isn't going to care. They don't care about being logical. So I'm going to skip another head tool. It's in the notes if you want to look at it. But let's go to one of the heart evaluations. And the point of the heart evaluation is to kind of, in this case, make them swallow the consequences of what they're saying and let them see how it tastes. Okay, that was a weird thing to say, I know. But let them see, can I live with the consequences that I'm saying I'm okay with? So let's think about how postmodernism would fit with our consciences. We've seen and we've heard postmodernists will say that there are no absolute moral values. That's like their thing when it comes to ethics. But however many times they say that, we can observe as human beings that there is a near, maybe it's just as a universal or near universal human intuition that there really are some things that are morally absolutely bad versus good. There are some moral standards that do apply to everyone, everywhere, and we all believe it. For example, sexual abuse, always wrong. Sexually abusing, especially violently sexually abusing young children, always wrong. And we all would say, if someone doesn't think that it's wrong, we would say something is wrong with them. Something's messed up with them. They'd be a sociopath of some kind. Even a postmodernist would have to confess that. And what that means is that the postmodernist view of ethics it's super counterintuitive to our real life experience. It goes against all of our basic moral intuitions. But trying to think about their view, remember that they say that morals are always person or society relative. So let's see if we can challenge them specifically on something like that. Let's see if they really want to say that if an individual has developed his own moral standard, that that standard is as good as any other moral standard. And it's very easy to grab any kind of example you want to try to show that this is so counterintuitive we can't actually live with it. So I won't go into detail for the sake of time, but think of names like Jeffrey Dahmer, a murdering cannibal, Larry Nassar, sexually abusing young women, Jeffrey Epstein, doing the same kind of thing. All these names should ring a bell, all despicable men for one reason or another. But as the postmodernists, why would we want to punish these men so harshly if they were simply acting according to their own moral compass, which just happens to be different than ours? Would a postmodernist be willing to say that these men were actually well within their rights to develop their own moral system and then consistently live with them? I pray not. I pray a postmodernist wouldn't be okay saying that. But what they might do, if you bring these up, if they can't handle saying, yes, what they were doing was okay, they might go back to the argument of morals being societally defined, that you are accountable to your society for your behaviors according to the standards of the society. So because in our society we say these things are wrong, they were wrong at the societal level. That might help them with these three guys, but I don't think it's going to help their case overall. How about Nazi Germany, right? You hate to invoke the Nazis for an argument, but were the Nazis objectively wrong and those complicit with them for what they did? Wrong by whose standard, right? What right did the Nuremberg trials have to come in and say, stop it, society, stop acting according to your own moral standards. We are now going to hold you to a higher set of moral standards. Death penalty for you. What gave the Nuremberg trials the right to do that? Or how about the Mayan culture? We keep digging up more examples of how the Mayan culture would sacrifice humans, religiously. They thought that the sun would cease to rise if they ceased doing their ritual sacrifices. Were they wrong to believe that? Were the bad guy colonizers who told them to stop it, were they wrong? What gave them the moral authority to come in and stop them from doing what they were doing? Or one of my favorites, which is a weird thing to say, I'm not a psychopath. But there's a Hindu custom known as sati that was in Indian societies. When a man died, you know, they often burn the bodies there. What they would do is they would put the still alive widow on the burning pile as well and burn her along with the body. This was a very widespread practice. And it only stopped when the British went in to colonize India in the mid-1800s. But were they wrong? Was what the Indians were, what the Indian people were doing, was it wrong? Was it okay for the Brits to come in and say, stop it? To say, we need you to stop burning people alive? Here's why I say it's one of my favorites. You may have been wondering that. But we have record of what General Sir James, Charles James Napier had to say about this. He was the British Army commander in India, one of the ones trying to put a stop to these burning practices. And he was told that the Hindu priests were not happy with him. They were pretty upset that they were coming, that the Brits were coming in and prohibiting them from acting according to their national traditions, their religious traditions. And we have record of the general's response. He said, "Be it so. This burning of widows is your custom. Prepare the funeral pile. But my nation also has a custom. When men burn women alive, we hang them and confiscate all their property. So my carpenters shall therefore erect gibbets on which to hang all concerned when the widow is consumed. Let us all act according to our national customs." So he obviously didn't do that, right? He was making a point. He was reducing the idea to absurdity just by taking it to its logical conclusion. So he was doing an old school reductio ad absurdum, which is exciting for me. That's why it's my favorite. I'm not a weirdo, at least in relation to that. So our consciences can't tolerate this point of view. I want to do one more because I spent time on the slide and it was fun to do. And it's another bumper sticker, so hopefully it sticks in your brain. But this is talking about universal tolerance again. Can we actually live with universal tolerance in practice? So this is the bumper sticker I was looking for when I found the other one. You've probably seen this coexist bumper sticker on all kinds of enlightened people before. But I want to use this sticker and the idea of universal tolerance to see if it's even possible in practice. Now, it's a cleverly designed sticker, I'll give it that, but we have the Muslim crescent as the C, the peace sign as the O, the E's got the male and female symbols on it, we've got the six-point star of David as the X, the I has the five-pointed star of paganism on it, the S has the yin and yang of Taoism, and then the T is the Christian cross, so it's nice to be included on there. But, you know, we have the word coexist here with all these religious symbols, with the obvious point being, you know, can't we all get along? Can't all these religions just peacefully coexist with each other? Why can't all these religions just tolerate one another and get along? I found online a spoof version of this bumper sticker, which the spoof is probably a better refutation of this whole idea than any kind of well-formulated argument. I had to recreate it myself to get it to work here, so unfortunately these symbols are now in my Google search history. But what about this version? What would the coexist crowd think about this version? So you can see, if you can't see, the E was replaced with the communist hammer and sickle, and the X was replaced with the Nazi swastika. And at least for the time being, the majority of people would view these symbols as signs of hate and intolerance and wicked regimes. And apparently, this spoof was posted on a talk radio website for a talk show up in Milwaukee, and there was a local organization known as the Interfaith Conference, a group that was just dedicated to tolerance above all else. Well, they were outraged about this, and they demanded that this spoof be taken off the website. So apparently this tolerance group supporting coexistence was not prepared to coexist with the guy who made this, or more importantly, the ideas that have been imported into it. They were not prepared to coexist and tolerate everybody. So they were living contrary to their own professed beliefs. And I think you could share this with any coexist person, and they would start to make all kinds of qualifications for why we shouldn't tolerate those, but we should tolerate everything else. And if you don't tolerate that, you won't be tolerated. Something like that. So this kind of universal tolerance, it can't actually be lived out in practice. And usually what's meant by these things is all you religious types just don't actually believe what you say you believe, don't actually teach what your religion teaches. But that's how we can talk. If you ever come across a postmodernist in practice, you can try to talk along these things and hopefully ultimately get them to what their foundation is and challenge the foundation. But we see this kind of stuff everywhere. So to quickly wrap up, I'm taking a long time. To a point that I skipped on coherence, I just wanted to point out really quickly. The Christian worldview, unlike the postmodernist nonsense, we actually can support coexistence to an extent. The Christian ethic does support genuine tolerance and existence and coexistence, but not one that sacrifices truth or sacrifices reason or moral standards. And thereby, we can see why the Christian worldview is the superior worldview, especially when compared to postmodernism. Not just because it's got like better conclusions, because it's actually true. It's the actual true worldview. It's the only truly coherent worldview. In terms of coexistence, we can actually live alongside and even love and pray for people that disagree with us. And we can do that without ever conceding the truth. We can do it while still loving people and wanting them to know the truth as well, not so that they agree with us, but so that they might come to saving faith in Jesus Christ as well. We're the only worldview that truly does desire to coexist, but not coexist with nonsense ideas, coexist with human souls that need redeemed. You have 2 minutes if you have any questions. I went longer than I intended to, and I'll blame it on the PowerPoint. But are there any questions or thoughts about postmodernism?
Where would they stand on evolution if you don't have any kind of knowledge?
Right. So if you were following postmodern, so the question was, where do they stand on evolution? So postmodernism would have to say that there's no objective reality of how we came to be. Any religion that has a creation myth, for them that's true, and that's what happened, right? But most people aren't consistent postmodernists. Kind of mentioned before, they pick and choose. What you typically find is they are naturalists in terms of origins of thing, but then they'll punt it whenever they need to to make the point. So what, at least if I were in conversation with one, I would be mostly asking questions to them. I'm going to use a term that Greg Bonson used, so don't think I'm a weirdo again. He'd say, you give them enough rope to hang themselves. not that I want them to die, but I want them to come to their own conclusion that what I'm saying doesn't make any sense. And you hope that that puts a rock in their shoes so that they go home and think about what they actually believe. And maybe providentially they come back to you with some more questions. But for most of these things, there isn't a universal answer because they reject universal answers. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, you know, is self-refuting, and what we're talking about of this like global perspective, it's really not at all. So.
Yeah, so I guess when they say, where they might say there is no God, that's not what they mean. They mean I am God, right? Reality is what I make of it. Very true. Yeah?
So when you're talking, you talk about yourself, and when you're talking to postmodernists, you're talking to, I have found in my experience that, as you put it, they don't care about the logic of it, right? So you'll ask a question that is obviously self-refuting, right? So, you know, there is no truth. Well, is that true? And how do you handle when you're talking to it? Because almost every time I've ever been in a situation like that, what happens is you ask a question like that, and then you get, well, you must hate puppies.
Right.
What? And it becomes, immediately they start attacking you as a human about something that's completely irrelevant. Because there's no argument, and when they get into this instant illogical attack mode, it becomes hard to even converse, right? So
it does, yeah, and it's very difficult to not get frustrated yourself when you're asking them those questions because you just want them to say a coherent thing. It takes, I would say, prayer for your own attitude in those encounters, and I would suggest, as talked about in the tactics class a couple semesters ago, sticking with the questions, asking them questions, not in a gotcha tone, but in a genuine, I want to know what you actually believe type of tone. There's not going to be, oh, here's the two things that you ask them and they walk away crying or something. It's genuinely asking them questions to make them think about it. There's no way you're going to convert them from postmodernism to Christianity yourself anyway. You're relying on the Spirit to do those things. So it's, can I ask the person enough questions to get them thinking more clearly? And then how, before the end of this conversation, can I plant some seeds of the gospel in there? And what they do with it is up to the Lord. But there will be a lot of frustrating conversations with a postmodernist. Yeah, right?
I just wonder what percentage of our population actually believes this, and whereas if there's just an elite group of people that are in powerful places that are just keep pushing this on us. And I sit there driving down the road last night, coming back from Iowa, shaking my head on stuff on the radio, and I'm thinking, is there people that actually believe this?
Yeah. I don't know if there's a person that is a full-bore postmodernist, because I don't know how they even brush their teeth in the morning to live that way. What you typically see is people are postmodernists when convenient for it. And it's convenient. I got to be careful of how I'm speaking here, but if you have an agenda, postmodernism can be helpful for you. To remove distinctions, to remove absolute truth in certain scenarios can be advantageous if you're trying to make a certain kind of argument. So I don't know if there were a poll, people saying, yes, I'm a postmodernist, because I don't know if they could take a poll. I don't know what that would do to their brain if they took a poll. So I don't know. So we don't really see very many pure postmodernists. We see people who have been being deceived into espousing postmodern thought in certain things. Anything more? I don't want you to be late for second service. I usually walk in a good 3-4 minutes into the first song, but I don't want that to be your practice as well. Okay, I'll pray. We are back next week, and then the week of the 11th. We will not be meeting, and we'll be meeting again after that. So we will be back next week, though, so I hope to see you back here. But I'll pray, and we'll close. Gracious God and Father, we're so thankful for how you have chosen us in you, and how you've revealed yourself through your word, that we know that you are not a God of confusion. You have defined what reality is. You've given us understanding of what you are like and what that means we should be like. Thank you for removing those veils from our eyes. Father, we pray that you would do the same to our town, our friends, our peers, our family, our nation, our planet. And we know that one day you will do that, that one day every knee will bow and every tongue confess that you are Lord. Father, in the meantime, we pray for wisdom, for knowing how to interact with these ideas as ideas, as well as people that hold these ideas. Pray that we would be gracious and patient with them, knowing that but before your grace, we would be the same way. Thank you for this morning. Hope it was beneficial to us and God glorifying, and that we brought glory to your name. Pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.